What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our guest today is Emile Sautonier de Weaver. Emile is a formerly incarcerated activist, widely published essayist, owner of Reframe LLC, and a 2022 Soros Justice Fellow. California's Governor Brown commuted his life sentence after 21 years for his community work. He has written for publications including the San Francisco Chronicle, San Jose Mercury News, Color Lines, The Appeal, and many more. He lives in Oakland, California. His book that we will be discussing today is Ghost in the Criminal Justice Machine, Reform, White Supremacy, and an Abolitionist Future. Welcome, Emile. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kat. It's really good to be here.
We're going to start our conversation actually by walking a bit through your personal story. Talk about your childhood, whatever you feel, you know, willing and safe to share, where and how you grew up.
Okay, so like I had a childhood that stretched across like various like class sectors. Like my dad was a doctor, my mom was a professional, eventually became an attorney. But our house was pretty like destroyed by domestic violence, which destroyed all the trust. It was also just kind of destroyed by kind of like the ideologies and like the frameworks of a certain brand of Christianity. And I'm like, have never felt connected to that faith. So there was like a lot of like trauma and distrust there and a lot of violence there, because it was the kind of belief system that was like enforced with violence. And so my earliest memories are like deep East Oakland on 98th. Then my parents got divorced, and I was with my grandma in Southern California for a while. And then once that settled, we were living in West Oakland in my dad's doctor's office. And then kind of like the lovely years of my life relatively is like when my dad bought a house up on Wawona, which is like by Lakeshore on the border of Oakland and Piedmont. And that was kind of like our upper middle class life for a while. My dad lost all his houses, lost most of his practices, kind of wrapped up in this con to like save like the Black community. Intentions were like really good, but like the wrong people got a hold of him and he lost everything. Then we were back living in deep East Oakland in another one of my dad's doctor's offices. I was like in and out of juvenile institutions from the age of like 12 until I was 18, at which point I went to prison for the crime I talk about in this book. And I spent my life growing up in juvenile institutions, and I spent my adult life growing up in prison from 18 to like about 39. And that's my childhood.
Your father comes up a lot in the book, seeming he had a major influence on your worldview. I'm wondering if you can say more about him and the things that he taught you that has shaped some of your current analysis about patriarchy, white supremacy, gender norms, etc.
Yeah, my dad is like, dad is a complicated, larger than life figure. And he's like taught me so much through what he did right, through what he did wrong, through what he didn't do. Like everything became such a powerful lesson in my life that has like rescued me so many times and has shaped who I am today. But I think like starting with the good things is, you know, my father taught me through like through his actions, through his failures, and through his words, like some of the most important things in this world are fatherhood, our black community. And like a good example of that would be like, you know, we would wake up sometimes and find like a homeless man living on our couch, and my dad would like give him work. And, you know, my dad, he grew up poor in Baltimore, Jim Crow. And so like, He on many levels, he understood white supremacy, and he was trying to prepare us for it. Like we were the kids who, like where everybody else was playing during summer vacation, we were writing book reports on Malcolm X. And at the other, and on the other end, like he knew so little about white supremacy, especially the internalized kind. And he thought that we could like perform our way out of white supremacy, like we could excel our way out of it, like we could respectability politic our way out of it. And that's kind of like where we disconnected a lot in our like approach and view of the world, and why there was like so little trust between us, in addition to like the deep levels of violence that existed in our household. And that was like another kind of aspect of like white supremacy he didn't understand. He didn't understand that like his version of patriarchy was so steeped in white supremacy that he was building the very thing he was trying to protect his children from. Mm. He didn't understand that, like, you know, I talk about it in my book about like the imagination problem and cultural hegemony and what that means for like our spiritual practices in Black communities, and how we've been handed down to us what feels like spiritual practices from the people we've trusted the most in our life, from the people who are our ancestors, without really accounting for the work of what colonialism was in West Africa and on these United States on plantations. Does that answer your question?
It does. It does for me, if it does for you.
Yeah.
Tugging a little bit at some earlier life strings, what was your first encounter with law enforcement? There's a reference in the book about them, cops, kicking you unconscious from the time you were a young teen. That just sat with me in a particular way.
Yeah, so like when they were kicking me unconscious, like I was like 14, and like my encounters with them started long before that, when my dad used to drive us to Pleasant Hill to this Christian private school that we were enrolled in, and they would like pull him over every week to harass him in front of us and just kind of let him know that like you're a Black doctor, but you are Black before you are anything, and we're going to show you. And so those were like my earliest memories of the police. And then, you know, by the time I was a teenager and I was in the street life and I was selling dope and running from police, police were like, I've like always had this thing when I'm hearing these narratives about like how the police are under siege and how they need military grade weapons because the streets are crazy and the youngsters are like, you know, dangerous. And it's just like, that is so dissonant for me. Because like we were kids and we were on the streets and we were certainly doing shit we shouldn't supposed to be doing, but we were kids. Like police are literal trained killers. Like they put time, they get paid in their work day to go to shooting ranges and get really good at shooting guns, right? So when the police came, we were scared. Like the idea that like we wanted to fight the police was, that's like insane. When the police came, we ran, right? And they chased us. And when they caught us, they'd beat the shit out of us for running. Like, as like kind of a form of terrorism, like this is what happens when you run. This is what happens when you resist. And we are going to instill terror in you as a form of control, even when we are not here, even when we don't have our hands on you.
Yeah, and you talk about the, you know, policing and the Crossville State. I'm summarizing, of course, not using the exact words, as a terrorist organization, which I really appreciated, with my other hat on, you know, as co-founder and ED of the Anti-Police Terror Project. Because when people ask like why we call it terror, is because the Webster defines terror or terrorism, right, as using violence to force people into behaving a particular way or subjecting themselves to an ideology. And I think you would agree, like police are the front lines of white supremacy's efforts to have us do that.
Yeah, I definitely agree, right? Like I feel like I like to dig even deeper into the definition. Like I think I got the international definition of like terrorism to like go with Merriam-Webster, and it's like intimidation and violence to achieve political and social aims.
Yes. Yes.
And that's exactly what the police do. Like they do it with so-called criminals, and they do it with just regular people in their house. They do it when they pull you over on the side of the road, right? Like You know, and it's like, you know, and for people who like, that's a scary thing to face. Like, I understand why it's so hard to have this conversation in the United States. That's a scary thing to face. The police have an inhumane amount of power at their disposal. So it's much easier to like pretend that they're the good guys and they're on our side, because to face the other reality is quite terrifying. But like, and I give this example in the book, it's like, if you want to like test your belief in this, like just imagine like two police officers talking in a dark alley, and imagine yourself approaching them. And now imagine you telling them, man, f*** the police in that dark alley. Would you do that? Would you do that? And if you wouldn't do that, why wouldn't you do that, right? Why wouldn't you do that? Why is that not a sensible thing to do? And even a professional upper class white man knows that that's probably not the thing to do.
Look, in my head, I'm like, well, it depends on the day. But yes. You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We are in conversation with Emile Sautonnier de Weaver about his new book, Ghost in the Criminal Justice Machine, Reform, White Supremacy, and an Abolitionist Future. Emile, one of the things that I talk about in the world is that the state creates the conditions for violence in our community, right? Through the denial of resources and jobs and housing and right basic necessities. And then what they offer us as a solution, right? The way that we get safe is through more violence. And by that, I mean the violence of the carceral state. And I'm wondering if through that lens or your take on that lens, if you can walk us through the material conditions created by the state that landed you in prison as a baby with a 67-year sentence.
Yeah, I mean, that's both easy and complicated, but I just get through it. It starts in those drives my dad was taking every day to drop us off to this like pretty much all white school that was like riddled with racism. Like, we've been like chased to the BART station by skinheads and trucks. So like setting this frame for like the so-called natural order of things where like black bodies aren't safe. Of course, the black children who are experiencing this know this isn't just and feel anger about this, and like any human wants to resist this in the ways that they can, but like we're children, so like our strategy, our ability to strategize, right? Like if I had the mind to be like, oh, I'm gonna get into activism, if someone had introduced me to activism, that's what I would have been in as a teenager rather than the streets selling dope. And then it moves even further along the track on that in school as like police enter schools. I remember the first time that like the police were called on me in school because of this like conflict I was having with another student. Like, I stopped coming to school because I was like, oh, the police are trying to get me. I'm not going to go there where the police can get me. And so school is like supposed to be our pathway out of like poverty or out of disadvantage. But schools are also designed to push us out so that when we're pushed out, people can point at us and be like, oh, you see, they had an opportunity to do better, but they don't want to take it. So that's on them. The state gets to jump on this narrative of these are throwaway people, right? They can't be helped. And so people turn a blind eye to like the police violence that like happens to us on the street. And like, I can't emphasize how crucial understanding police violence is to understanding how the conditions of incarceration and violence and patriarchy are perpetuated in Black communities. Because like, you know, we hear talk all the time about gangs, like, oh, the problem is gangs. But if you know anything about gangs, if you actually do research into gangs and understand like where they came from, gangs came as a response to police. Mm-hmm. Right. And the poison pill that is gangs in Black communities, when you see how wrong they always go, you can find the parallel in that. That's because gangs are structured like police. People often say, oh, police, the police are the gang. Police are the biggest gang in Los Angeles. Like, that's true, but you have the causation reversed. Police didn't hang around gangs and then become gangs or like take that influence. gangs took their character from police. Right? And so that's kind of long-winded. So I'm going to try to soundbite it a little bit. The ways that the state perpetuates mass incarceration and white supremacy is by perpetuating internalized white supremacy, of making us the white supremacists, by telling us this is the way to think, this is the norm, this is civilization, whether it's retribution, whether it's like disposability. And we grow up thinking like this. Like, people can have all kinds of critiques for people living on the streets, but the reality is they are just stone cold capitalists. Like, everybody I know who is out selling dope on the streets and in prison and like and getting out, like, we're fairly successful people because we understand the principles of capitalism really well. That's all we were doing out there. Mm-hmm. We just weren't doing it on the approved channels. We don't have permission to be successful. So we're criminalized, right? So I think that's the biggest thing the state does to perpetuate these conditions, is it teaches us to think and be like a white supremacist state. And that becomes our model and the principles from which we think from. So all we do is produce more of the same, even when we think we're producing something different, even when we think we're trying to carve a way out for ourselves, even when we think we're resisting and doing activism against the system.
Oh, and we're going to get into some more of that later, because I'm going to return to some of the points you make in the introduction. Staying here for a minute, once incarcerated, what was it that ignited your journey of transformation that was outside of the way mainstream normally thinks about so-called rehabilitation?
For me, the thing that started my big change, my big transformation in prison, was like the birth of my daughter. I saw them when they were like a week years old through a glass, and that changed my life. Like their eyes changed my life, because I started to think of who they were going to see, the world they were going to see, the father they were going to see as they got old enough to understand what a father was. And that was terrifying, because I know what I saw, right? And I know what society was going to tell them. And so and I knew that they couldn't grow up to be ashamed of me or hate me without also being ashamed of themselves and hating themselves. I knew that because of my relationship with my father. And I was just terrified and devastated at that prospect for my child. So at that moment, I was like 19, and I was like, this has got to change. I've got to do something different. I've got to create something else. And that started my drive. And, you know, rehabilitation wasn't a big thing in 1998. So I was kind of doing my own thing. I was doing my own reading. I was doing my own soul searching. Part of like writing became a part of my soul searching process. The more I wrote, the more I understood myself, the more I understood people, the more empathetic I became. And I also kind of just grew up. Like, like the thing that's important to understand is, like, I was a child when I went to prison. Right. And so, like, I wasn't even a man. And so I became a man in prison. And with becoming a man in prison, that also becomes a deeper sense of responsibility, that also becomes more empathy, that also becomes a better understanding of the world. So all of these things packed together began my transformation. And I did that independent of a state telling me what transformation was, so that by the time I reached a point where rehabilitation was like a lot more popular, like 15 years into my sentence, I had a little bit more protection against the power of narrative control that the state was employing in these rehabilitative programs. And I wasn't proof against it, but I had enough of an anchor point that the more I understood and the more I grew in it, the easier it was for me to see the poison pill hidden in the state's rehabilitation programming.
And that's actually a perfect segue to my next question. And that is, I guess, two part, right? Talking about the ways in which we currently define rehabilitation that reinforces white supremacy and its values. And then tucked underneath that, I have the relationship between the narrative of personal accountability and rehabilitation.
they're actually the same question, because the narratives attached to rehabilitation are about personal responsibility. It's about offloading all of society's responsibility for the society it has made and the way it channels Black bodies into prisons to serve a white supremacist end, and taking all that responsibility and putting that on the person who has the second least power to like change the situation, right? That the person who has the most least power is the person who was actually victimized by whatever crime has occurred. And they turn this into a pathological process where the incarcerated person undergoing rehabilitation is essentially taught to hate themselves, right? Which is great for malleability, for like breaking, like they do in the army with boot camp, for like breaking someone down to build them back up in the image you want them to be. But the image that rehabilitation wants you to be is not like so much a changed person, but one, like a neutralized threat to the status quo, and in the best case scenario, a proponent for the state's narratives and doctrines, so that they, you know, like the Candace Owens of the world, so that they can point to someone and say, see, this Black person says we're right. They do the same thing with incarcerated people. See, this incarcerated or formerly incarcerated person says this is just. So like, yeah, go rehabilitation. It works. So that's the nutshell of like the rehabilitation process. And then the personal accountability process, the outcome of that, of creating a world where personal accountability is the litmus test, is creating a world where nothing can ever change, where nothing will ever change, because personal accountability is not going to change these systems. It's not going to change this world. It's not going to change injustice in this world. Right. And the people and the architects of the system understand that, which is why they funnel us towards it. The only thing that's going to change is a collective responsibility, is a on all sides, not just a person who committed harm in the community, but the community parts of the community that engendered it and grew it, parts of the community that let it happen, parts of the community that abandoned the people it happened to, like all of these stakeholders have a role to play in collective change.
You say in the book that you wrote your way out of prison. What does that mean, and how did that happen?
It's funny. It literally means what it is, what it says. But like when I came to that commitment, what I thought it would mean was that like I would write this best-selling novel, I would get rich, and you know, I would buy my way out of prison, because you know that's the way America works. What it actually meant was, the writing process changed my life and changed my sight. And so it created in me the person who was capable of getting out of prison. And then two, the writing process also created a professional life where I built a network of people who supported my release. When it came down for me to file my commutation, I had like 40, 50 letters of support from people all the way from Amazon Audible to professors at Stanford to correctional officers to like, and this was just based on the relationships that I had built through my writing and through the work that I platformed off my writing. And then we come to the literal thing of filing a commutation. At the time I was like doing work with activists from inside prison, I was doing work with activists outside of prison. And at the time, I was in a relationship with one of the people. They were my partner at the time. And they were like, so Tanya, why don't you file for a commutation? And I'm like, I'll file for one, but I got to do something first. And they convinced me. It was like, you have done something. File the commutation, right? So the commutation is just like four essays to the governor asking them to commute your sentence. And I approached that process as a writer, like which included like research and understanding and like understanding your audience. And I took like 3 or 4 months like crafting that commutation in the same way that like, you know, writers might spend a couple of months like crafting a proposal for a book. And I submitted it, and like they called me in for an interview like a week later, which was unheard of. Like people had filed commutations and been waiting years to hear nothing, right? But there's no framework for them. And I was freaked out. And then I went in there and I talked and like 3 months later, they commuted my sentence. So it was literally my essays, a bunch of essays that I wrote to the governor that got me out of prison. And so it didn't happen the way I imagined it would happen, but it really was a writing my way out of prison.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We're in conversation with Emile Sautonnier de Weaver about his book, Ghost in the Criminal Justice Machine, Reform, White Supremacy, and an Abolitionist Future. Emile, I want to go back to the beginning of the book, really the introduction, and look at your definition of white supremacy. You start the book, quite honestly, with some concepts that immediately challenge the reader, right? They can either look at themselves in the mirror or they can put the book down. And particularly, I'm talking about Black folks and the reference to Black folks as white supremacists, rather than simply asserting that Black folks carry within us white supremacist value systems or beliefs. I'm wondering if you can say more about that.
Yeah, I feel like there can be a distinction made between practicing white supremacy, primarily because you've internalized it in being a white supremacist. But I don't think that distinction is helpful because the outcome and the results are the same. And I think it's not that different from like when we're talking to white people about like some of the problematic shit they do. And generally they're like, yeah, but I mean well, I have a good heart. And we're like, I know you mean well, and that doesn't mean anything right now, right? Compared to what's actually happening, right? I think it's the same principle at play there. Like we could have an hour conversation about how Black people are good-hearted and how we're powerful and how we do resist white supremacy, and we can lose track of the plot that we are creating white supremacy through patriarchy, through homophobia, through transphobia, through our obsession with the nuclear family, through our obsession with religions that replaced our native religions as part of a colonization project. These are the things that we need to get a hold of because white people aren't going to fix white supremacy. We are the only people who have any incentive on its face in the current frameworks that exist, mental frameworks that exist to end white supremacy. So we got to look at how we are undermining our own power. And we got to look at how what we need to do to build power that's ours and not borrowed from a system that can ultimately take it from us at any moment, so long as we continue on this borrowing system.
I want to connect what we were just talking about to what you just said, because you also said that in order to write your way out of prison and in order to get out of prison, you yourself had to at least appear to conform to some of these white supremacist values.
Yeah. And I didn't just appear. I did, because I didn't understand them. Mm. I didn't understand what it was. Right? I thought it was, this is what it means to be a good person. And that's the powerful trick that's pulled. Right. And that's the reason why I feel like it's so important for the reader to understand that you can understand what I did as a human and you can empathize with me, but you need to understand that it's white supremacy. I can understand that my father did the best that he could and he was an amazing man in many respects. And he was still a white supremacist. That's what we got to understand. Otherwise, we don't understand what white supremacy is. Mm. And if we don't understand what it is, then we cannot move it. We cannot dismantle it. And that's the thing. I like what you said. It's like, yeah, the introduction is kind of a challenge. It's like, take the challenge or put the book down. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, in popular, in like, you know, I have to understand branding because like I am a product in this world. And like the feedback I often get is, this idea that like the things that I talk about don't make people feel good and that doesn't sell. And the thing is like, for me, like I'm not like categorically different than other humans. Like I want to feel good and it doesn't feel good to have to like face some of these ugly realities. But at the same sense, I have found a way to not be depressed by it, but not be only depressed by it, but to feel power in it, to have hope in it. because you can't fix a problem if you don't see it clearly. And the more clearly we see it, the more power we have. And the more power we have, the more hope we have.
I love that. The more power we have, the more hope we have. Emil, in your answer there, you were talking about the importance of understanding white supremacy. I want you to tug on the thread that you do in the book about how the maintenance of white supremacy not only requires, well, the establishment requires violence, right? But the maintenance of it also requires the need to establish cultural dominance. What do you mean by that?
So it's like there's a limit to how much you can enforce with like just pure physical violence or the threat of physical violence. It's effective, right? But there's a limit, which is why colonialism broke down from its old form to the form we see today. They outsource the violence. They outsource the perpetuation of white supremacy. Like a chapter that didn't make it into the book was an examination of like Indian reservation schools in Canada, because it was the clearest example of white hegemony that I have ever seen, right? And we don't have a lot of those. But what they would do is they would take Native children from their families, from their cultures, put them in these reservation schools, explicitly have the plan to surround them with nothing but white values, nothing but white ideas, so that even if they rebel, they could only rebel on white terms. And we see the results of that today, and that now that mass graves are being unearthed in Canada of like Native children who were like killed in these schools, and like the people who are like done with colonialism and the colonial influences are protesting and fighting, and they're even like burning down Catholic churches. You have other people, other Native people defending the Catholic Church, defending like demonizing the people who are trying to fight to have back what they was taking from them. So now you have a fight between one, not between Native people and white Canadians who have taken their land and taken their culture. You have a fight between Native people and Native people, right? Mm-hmm. And so like it's these kind of maneuvers that make white supremacy sustainable, that become sustainable because they create white supremacists of us, and we do their work for them. And then the people who wake up and decide, no, we're going to fight this, they're not fighting white people, they're fighting other people like them. So we're using our resources on each other, in essence. So whoever wins that battle, we're spent. If you just take like a battlefield metaphor, we're spent. We've been fighting like the Spartans of 300 on the battlefield doing this impossible thing at some mountain pass. We're tired. And then the people who we really need to fight, they just come in and clean up and start the hegemonic process all over again, because we don't have the power to fight them now because we spent it fighting each other.
Ooh. Let's take that and put it into this political moment that we're in right now, right? I'm sure you, like me and other folks that are in leadership in this work, and begin to question, well, what do we do, right? What do we do now? And this is Trump 2.0. What do we do now with more open fascism? What do we do with the violence that's raining down? And I guess I'm going to pose that question to you like this. In this political moment, we're not just in the United States, but globally, we are witnessing whiteness and white supremacy try desperately to hold on to power in the status quo, right? We're seeing country after country swing further to the right than they were just a decade ago or two decades ago. How important is it that we understand the way whiteness and white supremacy work in terms of informing our organizing strategies?
It's paramount, but with that understanding comes a certain terror and a certain urgency that like kind of drives us to move forward and like answer this question that you just posed, like, what do we do now? But I think like, I'll say more, but the best answer, like I feel like, comes from Bayo Akumalafe. He says, times are urgent. Let us slow down. And I feel like I have been hearing that and wishing more people would hear that since they overturned Roe v. Wade, right? But the urgency of overturning Roe v. Wade, the urgency of the crisis in Palestine during the elections and what that did for a democratic process, a prospect that would like at least stall this that Trump is doing, is pushing us forward. But the thing is, we need to stop. We need to stop and breathe, because we have been outmaneuvered. And when you have been outmaneuvered, the worst thing you can do is rush forward. You will always remain two steps behind. You have to stop and start thinking through, how do we get two steps back ahead? Right now, to answer that question, how do we start to, like, there's no roadmap to this, but how do we start to get two steps back ahead is we need to get clear, one, about what white supremacy is and what's happening. We need to get clear on, like, what are strategies that take us forward and what are strategies that take us back. And within that calculus, we need to deprioritize our comfort, right? Because, like, a good example of this is, like, during the elections, like, if we were asking the question concerning Palestine and concerning the Democratic Party and the, like, corporate corporate influence that lives there as well as it lives in the Republican Party, but we asked the question, what moves us forward and what moves us backwards? A Trump election definitely moves us backwards. An election of Kamala Harris perhaps doesn't, maybe moves us backwards, but we know Trump moves us backwards. And Kamala Harris being president may not move us forward, but we can move forward in a way that we can't move forward in Trump. So for me, the calculus was, like, quite simple, painful as f, but quite simple. It's like, we need to make this decision that gives us the most power, not the most comfort. But so many people rolled out into that year of election and TikToks and Instagrams with the comfort as their priority of, I have the moral high ground, of, I will call this genocide and I will not vote for anyone who supports genocide, which means you won't vote for anyone, not the Green Party, not anyone, right? Because this is not an American support of genocide. In Palestine, this is a world support. Every Western government in my world, in my analysis, supports this, no matter what they say, because Israel's perfecting urban warfare. And the more we know about the way this world works, the more we are feeling unrest with our governments, and governments know that. And they know they need to have an answer for when it hits boiling points, right? So we need to get clear about what white supremacy is. We need to get clear about what effective strategy is and isn't, right? And there's no roadmap for that because of the imagination problem, because of cultural hegemony. We must experiment our way to it. And I think that a useful tool is also in the book, and that's, like, how to do power analysis in a way to understand that how your intervention redistributes power and hold ourselves accountable to the way we redistribute power with our strategies.
There's so much to unpack that. I know my listeners are like, I know what Kat's going to ask next, but Kat doesn't have time to ask so many of those things next. So I'm going to just ask you, what is your hope for this book in the world?
My hope for this book in the world is to begin a conversation that can be a democratic conversation about how we do this work. And what are the principles by which we work together, even though we are working apart? Because, like, the leg up that the right has is their fascist nature. Like, they're all in lockstep, and unity is power, which they have shown us. And we on the left are very much like, kind of like the ethos of, like, kind of, I want to do my own thing. I want to do what's important to me. And that can be good to a point, but there needs to be something that we are all accountable to beyond our own pet cause, beyond our organization, beyond our personal career, like a constitution, so to speak, that basically all people involved in movement and social change can find themselves accountable to and are accountable to. And that's not something that a book can do, but I hope that it is a conversation that my book can start, and we can come to some agreements about what we do and what we don't do and how we do things and how we don't do things, and have, like, the language to talk about it. When I first started this book, my main thing was, like, you know, we don't have the language to talk about the things that I want to talk about. And so, like, I was like, I need to write something that begins to create the language and frameworks for us to have these conversations in a way where we can hold each other accountable, and in a way where we can understand each other, in a way that we can see the bigger goal, the North Star, the thing that we can radically orientate towards.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We've been in conversation today with Emile Sotonia de Weaver. Emile is a formerly incarcerated activist, widely published essayist, owner of Reframe LLC, and a 2022 Soros Justice Fellow. California's Governor Brown commuted his life sentence after 21 years for his community work. He has written for publications including the San Francisco Chronicle, San Jose Mercury News, Color Lines, The Appeal, and more. He lives in Oakland, California. His book that we've been discussing today is Ghost in the Criminal Justice Machine, Reform, White Supremacy, and an Abolitionist Future. Emile, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Kat. I really appreciate it. It was a joy to talk to you, and we got to do this. We got to do this more. We got to fix this thing that has happened.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.